Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Mike Boris and this is Straight Talk.
What's the MMA deal? Or are you going to go and learn jiu-jitsu or do something?
The network might not allow me to.
You heal pretty quickly, especially if you eat the right food.
Was it bones heal, chicks dig scars? Is
that the... Mel Leong, welcome to Straight Talk. You're a little bit random in terms of things you do, but equally there's a common denominator. And the common denominator is what's someone's story. How can you bring that to life?
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
It's not dissimilar to what I've done on MasterChef, which is to be there to create a structure for other people's stories and to celebrate the stories of others. It's, for me, what I'm realizing as I get older and the longer I do this job is it's about the fascination with human stories. That's really what lights my brain up. There are so many different reasons and purposes for why people do what they do. And much like what you do with this podcast.
That's something I'm trying to find out from you today. Mel Leong, welcome to Straight Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love your shoes.
Oh, thank you. I love your shoes.
Mine are comfortable. I'm not saying yours aren't. But mine
That is the common denominator between our shoes is I like things to look nice, but they must be functional and therefore... In the case of shoes, comfortable.
They look very comfortable. But they look nice and they also look very comfortable. And Mel, if you don't mind me asking, you know, just because I always get curious about these things.
That's what we're
Leong,
here for.
You know, like sounds like a Chinese name. What's your, where were you born and or where were your parents born? And what's your actual ethnicity, your background?
My parents were born in Singapore. They're ethnically Chinese. And I was born in Australia, so I grew up in the Sutherland Shire.
Oh, you're a shy girl.
I'm a shy girl.
Wow. Indeed. Well, that gives you, by the way, that gives you a reputation straight up. We'll talk about that a bit later. No, okay. I'm only joking. So you grew up in the Sutherland area. So brothers and sisters?
Younger brother, 5 years younger.
Yeah, 5 years younger. And why did your parents come to Australia from Singapore?
I think the party line has always been to give their future children greater opportunities and to sort of open up the world a little bit. I think I love Singapore. I love Singaporean culture, but there is it's a very high stress environment. I think everybody would agree with that. And I think they wanted to give the idea of future children an opportunity to choose and to maybe have a different experience to what they had growing up.
It's an interesting place, Singapore. Like, I mean, I used to have a business there I had a business there, but we had clients there, customers there. Nothing to do with my financial service business. It was another business. And I used to go there quite often. And I couldn't believe – I find a really intense place. Mm. I don't know if you've been there back much, but It's a pretty intense place. You make a lot of money there, but unless you got a lot of money, it's really hard to enjoy the fruits of Singapore.
I agree. Look, money makes everywhere you live in the world easier, obviously. It gives you options. It gives you choices. In a place like Singapore, it's almost like a different world that exists if you have the means.
Yeah.
If you don't have the means and the way my grandparents grew up, there's lots of stories of the rise and the fall in families, but there was a big period of time where my grandparents did not have the means and grew up in HDB flats and all the rest of it. And it's a pretty challenging existence for sure.
And that probably would have been one of the reasons why your parents came here. They wanted to do something better for you. Mm. When they came here, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but know the answer to this, but do they immediately fit into, especially if they're living in the Sutherland Shire, but do they immediately fit into the, you know, the Australian genre, especially around that area? Because that's, you know, the Shire is pretty full on, you know. And my brother and sister grew up there, by the way. So I didn't, because they're much younger than me, but they grew up there.
It's a magical place, the Shire. It's so many things. It's special,
that's for sure.
So many people. What? They didn't immediately settle there. So yeah. They immediately settled in the inner city. So the very desirable suburbs that they are now were not so desirable. And I think, like a lot of migrants, you gravitate towards people in a similar community or with a similar background to you. And that was certainly the case for my folks, at least in the beginning. And then when we moved, well, when they moved out to the suburbs to live the great Australian dream, buy their own slice of paradise, however you'd like to call it. My mum shares stories about how much she prioritised wanting to fit in the working environment in particular.
And where did she work?
She was a registered nurse, so she was an RN at the time, and then she sort of moved on to being a nurse unit manager over time and hospital administrator and all the rest of it in the future. But at the time, coming in as a young nurse and a new mum and all of those things, she was very particular about she must only speak English at work. She wouldn't bring stinky foods to work. She would only bring sandwiches to work. It was all about blending in and being accepted.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Probably both of you and I are migrant family, but we both born here. But when I reflect on it, it's probably wasn't necessary. But nonetheless, it's them who made those decisions. And what was your dad doing? Your mum was a registered nurse. What was your mum doing?
My father was a draftsman. So he sort of worked
in an architectural office, and you're like in drafting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, but you're a writer and a foodie.
You're like trying to connect.
Yeah, I'm trying to work it out.
I'm always trying to connect the dots on.
Well, how did you become sandwich and food? Like, how did that work out?
That part's easy. If you are Singaporean, an interest in food is innate.
So it's a cultural thing. They brought from Singapore to here.
It's a cultural thing. If you are Singaporean, you have any experience living in that environment, you must become obsessed with food. Otherwise,
really?
You don't last.
Living in Singapore, you mean?
Either living in Singapore or being from Singapore in any capacity. I think it's a deeply cultural thing. And
can you explain that to me? Like, obviously I don't understand it, but can you explain it to me?
I think part of it is it's such a small place, and you know, houses are small, apartments are small, kitchens are small, and so eating out is a huge part of Singaporean culture. So almost every apartment block, every office building, the bottom of the street level of the building is almost always occupied by food vendors, hawker centres. Hawker centre culture is a huge part of the egalitarian part of Singapore. You know, it's accessible to everybody and everybody loves it. You know, it doesn't matter if you are pulling up in a Lamborghini or you happen to roll on down from the HDB down the road. If it's good food, you agree on it. And I think that's a wonderful thing about good food.
Yeah, definitely when it comes to good food. So does that mean, though, then growing up, whether you grew up in the city, inner city, or whether you grew up in Sutherland, it doesn't really matter. Is mum and dad sort of, you know, mum's working probably shift work too, giving a registered nurse definitely in the
night
early
shifts.
Days?
Yeah. We had very little family here. So my mother worked night shifts, my father worked an office hours. And that way someone could take care of me. And then when my brother came along, him as well. So
how does the food thing figure? Because, you know, we are not like that here in Australia, Australians anyway. We don't have a restaurant at the bottom of our building. In those days, my brother and sister, as I said, grew up in the Southern Shire. My parents moved there when I left home, sort of thing. But I remember they had a house in Sylvania, and there was one Chinese restaurant called Len Hong's just at the bridge at Sylvania.
Isn't it funny how it just sticks in the mind?
Tom Hugley's Bridge, there.
Yeah. Oh, I remember. Yeah. I remember
just across the road was the Greek hamburger person, the Zarafos's. And then
the seafood restaurant down the road.
That's right. And there was and then there's Len Hong's Chinese restaurant. But there wasn't much. in terms of Asian food in that area when I was going back to visit my parents, that I recall. So where was the food culture sort of germinated from? I know that the culture's there, I get it, but how did it get expressed?
We still ate out. Like, my parents sacrificed a lot. They worked very hard. We didn't go out a lot. It wasn't, we didn't do annual holidays or anything like that growing up until a little bit later. But we would inevitably gravitate towards communities where we knew that that good food was available. So for us, it was Bankstown, it was Cabramatta.
Oh, you go into the area.
Yeah, so we would go on little weekend trips and buy things. And the weekly tradition for me was, I grew up swimming. I had very bad asthma as a baby, and so swimming was just part of that that recovery process and making sure I was robust enough to survive, you know, the life. So my dad would drop me off at Bankstown swimming pool.
Oh, that's where I first learned to swim.
No way.
Seriously, yeah. A different coach, I'm sure. no, look, at Bankstown, 100%.
Yeah.
That's the very first place I learned to swim.
Well, there you go. We have that in common now.
And then he would have gone off to one of the...
So he'd go off and do some of the Asian grocery shopping for the week, because there are so many Asian grocers, a huge Vietnamese community.
Totally.
There.
Big. There's a street of Vietnamese restaurants at the back of Bankstown Sports Club.
So good. Pho aren't still to this day, you know, epic. But also, I was having a conversation with someone earlier about it. Enmeshed within that was still... the Greek and Italian populations, Lebanese community as well. And so you would have such an eclectic group of shops where you'd have an amazing continental deli next to a fantastic Asian grocer, and the mix of the smells and the sights and the sounds. It was just a very – Saturday was just this happy market day where families were running around and kids were everywhere. And so my dad would go and do some of the groceries, pick me up, and then the reward was always a curry puff and a coconut drink, and then we'd do the rest of the groceries and head on home, and that would fuel us for the week in terms of ingredients that we couldn't get at the local shops.
So where did your – that's your exposure, but where did you first become interested in food? I mean, as a – not as a profession, I guess, is but
– I'll tell you where. It was Yum Cha.
Where?
Yum Cha. Just not far from where you're talking about, there was eventually, I can't remember the name of it now, but a huge Chinese restaurant on the corner there. And almost every Sunday we would go to Yum Cha. And when I was old enough to invite friends from school, I would always be allowed to invite like one friend from school to come with me. And I realized pretty quickly how much delight I took in introducing friends who were not ethnically Chinese to the delights of dim sum.
And probably chicken's feet.
Oh, the discomfort on someone's face, you know, watching, that steamer butt, that's for us. Oh, that's going to be in front of me on the table. What do I do? Oh, I can't do that. And just watching them consolidate that sensory experience of the sights, the sounds, the smells of this sort of reasonably unfamiliar place. And Yum Cha restaurants are, it's a calamity.
It's theatre for me.
There's so much going on. There are waiters tossing plates all over the place. There are towering, there are towers of bamboo baskets just sort of balancing precariously. There's tea spilled on the table. There are sauce everywhere. It's just such a happy mess and such a brilliant time. I like to call it signs of a good time. You know, it's you can see the evidence. It's there on the white tablecloth in front of you, or maybe salmon-coloured tablecloth. It's always salmon. But I loved encouraging people to eat things that they were unfamiliar with, and sometimes it was a success, but always if they accepted the invitation to try something new, there was this sense of accomplishment that they would have, and I in turn would just feel so happy and satisfied that I had encouraged them to see food a little bit differently. And that happened from, you know, being a kid, like being 12. So
did you delight in their reactions? I mean, I can imagine, because I've done this, I did this sort of similar thing with kids with Greek food. But like, they never taste an olive, for example. They're like, what the hell? Because it's pretty salty, and some of the meals that we used to have. But I sort of similar sort of experience. We didn't go to restaurants, we mostly did it at family places, but I used to delight in their reactions.
I'm talking about a like humble places. Yeah. We grew up, fancy food, fine diners. That was a part of my later life. That was definitely part of my adult life. My parents are still wary of fine diners, I think. But anyway, sorry.
I'm similar. I'm still the same. But I used to delight in their response. Like, you know, oh my God, like, did you delight in the response of, I just keep thinking of chicken feet when I think of yum cha. But did you delight in the response when they went, what the hell? What the hell is that? Like, was that fun?
Shock value is always a little bit entertaining. I mean, I don't think I've done anything in my life deliberately to shock, but I think there's just something funny and light about humanity where we enjoy the juxtaposition. We enjoy that the crossroads where there's a bit of discomfort going on, but because there's also an opportunity to expand your perspective. And I was good or bad, the reaction good or bad, I was just fascinated in watching that process, like reading someone's face and just sort of seeing how they're taking on this new information and whether or not they're going to accept it or not. I don't know. I think it's just that fascination with people.
Yeah. So, because that brings me to the question of about curiosity. Do you think, given that you're a writer, you have to be curious, but do you have a curiosity as to the, forget about the, for the moment, about the taste and the colour and the.
How can you forget about that, Mark?
No, park it for a second. Right. But were you always curious about the theatre of people trying different types of foods? And because you did talk about the theatre of yum cha, there is a lot of theatre associated with it. Yeah. And it's not really put on. It's actual, that's just how it all rolls out.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, it wouldn't be the same if it wasn't there. So it's nearly like a precondition to having yum cha. You've got to have theatre. So if I'm running a yum cha joint, I'm actually going to make sure there's theatre because I want to make sure that everybody gets the full experience. So, but have you always been curious about the theatre of eating, the theatre that food provides?
Yes, I think so. And that has only grown the more I've incorporated food into my working life and my career and, you know, the inevitable existentialism of what I do. The dance of food, etiquette, the way people carry themselves in different environments, when you feel like a fish out of water in different dining environments when you don't know what to do with all this cutlery in front of you. There's an interesting discovery process involved in watching people undergo that experience or experiencing that for myself.
Yeah, because ultimately you were in the ultimate theatre. That's Master Chef, which we'll talk about in a second. But that's the ultimate theatre. But you did experience a theatre when you were a kid And also, I guess, not just yourself, but watching your friends' experience. And you tend to, did you find that you sort of, if you look back on it, it's sort of like you doing an assessment of audiences, you know, because you know, because they are your audience. I mean, your friend who you invite along, and then other people who are sitting in that room, in a yum cha room, which is not just Chinese people or Asian people. It's a full suite of different people. Yeah. And you're looking at you're sitting there observing all this stuff. It's a massive theatre. Do you reckon you ever took do you think subliminally you have taken something out of those experiences into the show?
I don't know about that. I think more simplistically it was more the essence of or the notion of hospitality.
But what is hospitality to you?
But it's about generosity. It's about making people feel comfortable to a degree, but also to maybe open up their world. So I can see where you're going with that, which is there is this, you know, this tipping point where it is both those things. But I am inherently a feeder, so I think what I was probably motivated by earlier on is wanting to give people things, wanting to give people experiences, and then delighting as a side effect in witnessing that.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So when you say you're a feeder, I think what you mean by that is you wanted to display generosity. Can I ask you about that? Because that's a very interesting, you know, what would be – people don't refer to that word these days as a virtue, but it is a well-known virtue going right back to Aristotelian times, back in, you know, 500 BC, 600 BC.
I love how anyone with Greek culture is always able to bring it back down.
Everything's got something to do with Greece.
It originated in ancient Greece.
Well, that's I'll tell you why, because we're limited to that knowledge. That's why we do it, because that's our only reference point. But if you go back, I mean, like, generosity is a well-known virtue. But I often wonder about, you know, it's like forgiveness, but I often look at things like generosity, and sometimes I look at generosity as not really someone being generous towards the other person, but they offer generosity because it rewards themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
It's nearly generosity, a selfish thing. I don't mean in a bad way.
No, I agree with you. That is completely correct. I think it's a two-way thing. There is a payoff for the person giving. Absolutely. If that's your love language, is to give, you derive enjoyment and satisfaction from observing the response to your actions.
Yeah.
And that part is I absolutely accept. So, where does
that come from in you then? So, like, I'm trying to work out, like,
I mean,
generous when you were young, you're still generous, you still play that. Because being a writer, you've got to be generous too. There's a lot of generosity being a writer. You've got to share so much stuff and you've got to put effort into it.
And you have to be real about it as well, because people know.
If you're bullshitting.
Absolutely.
So where does that come from in you? Have you ever thought that through about yourself? Why am I like that?
I think I've learned by example. I think my mum in particular is an incredibly generous person. That's one of her love languages. She's a nurse. Acts of service are part of who she is in a vocational sense, in a parental sense, and I've been the grateful recipient of that. And I think you learn by doing.
Yeah. Or what you see.
What you see, you do. If you can see it, you can be it, all of those things. Yep. And then later on you can choose if that suits you or it doesn't suit you. But I think I inherited that from her, and I come from a big family of particularly women who feel the same way about generosity. It's part of who they are. They do it because they enjoy it. And I'm just following that,
well, Mel, I mean,
that bloodline.
Because I often think about, why do I do not this show so much, but the mentor show. But it's because, you know, I will say, you know, I like to help people, but really it's reward based for me. They get a reward. They get something out of listening to me, I hope. But it's a reward in it for me. And what I know about myself is that I'm continually feeding my reward center of my brain. And, you know, obviously a lot of chemicals are being released that make me feel good. So it's a feel good effort from my point of view. And therefore I get very curious about people like yourself, who you call yourself a feeder and your mother's a nurse, so she's therefore a giver. And it's a good reward. It's not like taking drugs where you get a reward as well, because that fucks you up. But these things are high quality reward center based actions.
Sustainable.
Yeah, and sustainable through life, through your whole life. You can do this forever. And it can, and because when we look at why we're living on this planet, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, what is this? Well, it is basically about that, finding things that work well societally, that give us a reward and give someone else an outcome, a good outcome. Yeah. That's pretty much it. Whether it's, you know, having kids, which rewards everybody around us, or whether it's you know, doing what I do, or lending money to somebody, or guiding someone, or helping them out. In whatever, that's really at its most fundamental level. And food, of course, is one of the most fundamental ways of displaying that.
Yes.
And so you've adopted food.
Yeah.
As your reward center.
Absolutely.
It's not just because food is colourful, because food's a great instrument, because it's colourful, it smells, it tastes, it's tactile.
Yeah,
it's everything.
It's a multi-dimensional sensorial experience. There is alchemy involved in the transposition.
Oh, I love that word alchemy. I love that word alchemy. Can we just explore that word
Let's
for a second, please,
it.
Mel?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, of course, one of my favourite books is The Alchemist. Not because it's a bit of a kid's book, but when I say kids, like a younger person's book, but what it's sort
the
of.
The rite of passage.
The
book.
Philosophy of it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And obviously the you know, the moral of the story is pretty important too. But alchemy with food, I mean, Hest and Blumenthal's is probably the ultimate at that, you know.
For using Anadria, food and
turning,
you know,
something into something
so
weird.
So many, yeah.
But just a normal fun meal, I think, has alchemy in it. Like, and I'll tell you
why.
And I would like to hear what you say. I can be feeling like shit, and I can go to my sister's place, who's a great cook, and she will present to me a meal that's well cooked, well made, good ingredients, nothing fancy, made with lots of love. But also, she plays around with it the way it looks, and my community does this. Greek community does this all the time. And immediately my mood changes. Immediately. And I might go back to the mood after when I'm driving home.
It's magic.
But it is magical. Mm. And alchemy is about magic.
I actually think, as much as I deeply respect operators within the industry that have pushed food to, you know, beyond the bounds of what we could conceive as being food, it's where art meets science meets existentialism and all of the rest of it, The more time I spend in food, the more I believe that the simplest food, soul food, if you like, contains the most alchemy, contains the most magic, because its ability to transform your mood, to comfort you, to soothe you when you are hurting or you're sad, all of those things, to go to when you're happy and to celebrate, there's so much beauty in that. And I think that intangible feeling that you get from, you know, a bowl of chicken soup, you know, a bowl of congee, whatever it happens to be, some noodles, in any culture, in any language, you don't need to understand the existentialism of it, you just need to feel it. And that's, if nothing more, the most human thing that you can do and be in that moment.
Can I just sort of lean into a few of those words you use then? Comfort is a really good one for me. Comfort food. But probably you have a greater understanding of the emotions associated with food generally. But if we just lean into the word comfort, Asian people that I know, and also Greek people I know, but to a lesser extent, because what's Asian people have been here a lot shorter time than, say, the Greek people here. In terms of bigger communities I'm talking about. And I think it's sort of been bred out of the Greek community, getting bred out of the Greek community a little bit, but still quite fresh and new with the Asian community. They are much more attuned to, you know, I don't know, you mentioned the Vietnamese meals, like pho, however they pronounce it, or chicken soup, you know, like especially if you're not feeling well. You know, like chicken noodles or, you know, all those types of meals. This need, this sort of really important thing in my life, if I'm an Asian person, to try these foods, and I'll drive to Bankston or Cabramatta or I'll drive to Fairfield or wherever it is to experience it. Mm. It's so important I don't think it's cultural. I think it's individual. Individuals feel like they just need this. Where the hell, why is it so powerful?
The need to go to the ends of the earth to
try it out.
Pursue a particular meal.
Even if it's $14, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, the cheaper the better, really.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that's part of the game. It costs nothing.
That's the great thing about, you know, hawker food. Like if you go to a hawker market, the best chicken and rice, like Hainanese chicken and rice, might cost you $5. And everybody from billionaires to old grandmothers who have to, you know, count their pennies will go there for that.
What is that? That's in Singapore, I know, because there is a place called Hawker's Market or something like that.
Well, it's just a hawker centre is a place that you have lots of different outlets. It's like
they're little kiosks.
Like an indoor-outdoor food court.
Yeah, the one I went to was outdoor.
Yeah.
And if it rained, yeah, you're stuffed.
Like Maxwell is one of the most famous
what's
ones
called?
In Singapore, Maxwell Hawker Market. And right. It's a covered... covered sort of food court, but it's, you know, sort of it's an open air food court.
Well, if we bring it back to Australia, so, but no, but if we do, where is your equivalent to you? Where today does Mel want to go to find that, and why?
It's for me, food is deeply rooted in context. So it's about how you're feeling. It's about who you're with and what dish occurs to you that you need at that moment. Like, what's the perfect thing that's going to complete the picture?
Are you thinking about that before you go there, on the way there? Are you thinking
it's just it's just a feeling. So if I it might just be as simple as what I cook. So if I'm feeling a bit under the weather and I feel like I need something warm and brothy and soothing, it might not necessarily be, you know, Chinese food. Like I love cooking, from all sorts of different cuisines across the world, but Italian is a really classic one. I might want a bowl of, pastina and just make – it's the simplest broth in the world to make. It doesn't take very long. It's imbued with soul and you don't have to speak the language to understand why that is. You know, chicken broth, there's just something about it. It's universal. It comforts us. It's physically nourishing. We know that to be true. I'll make that.
It seems like every community has that, by the way. The Jewish people have it. The Italians have it. The Greeks have it.
These universal meat on
Chinese
sticks,
have it.
Meat on sticks.
Yep.
Fried chicken. Some kind of chicken soup. Some kind of dumpling. Like, there are these universal foods that almost every culture in the world will have meatballs, a version of it. And it means a great deal to them because it's what carries their particular preference for flavor profile and texture and all of those things. So it's universal, but it's also extremely nuanced to the consumer or to the originator.
Yeah. Do you think that we sort of build some sort of neurological response to how food becomes comfort food to us? Like, I know that there are some, I probably for a period of my life I sort of discarded these things. I stopped thinking about it. But then as I've got older, I'm starting to turn back to them.
Mm.
And there are certain types of biscuits, for example, and they're a Greek biscuits called kouloury, which I'm desperate to have when I have a coffee.
Mm.
But I probably haven't really thought about it for 40 years. But I think of my grandmother. They're sort of a dry biscuit and it's got a braiding pattern thing on it. Yeah.
It's a dipper. It's
and you put a little bit in there. It's got a bit of an orange taste. It's got not very sweet, it's got orange rind in it usually and a little bit of sugar and not much. It's not very sweet. It's more dry. But there are various meals that I'm starting to, as I get older, I'm starting to revert to, and I'm thinking, why am I thinking this? Why am I feeling unhappy with my life, or is it or is it just an age thing? What's the deal? I mean, do you have any views on that? Like, I feel like I'm in a therapy session with you. But
oh my goodness, I'm honored that you feel that.
Yeah, but because I mean, you study these things. I mean, you know these things.
I think the one word that comes to mind when you describe what you're describing is nostalgia.
Yeah.
You know, and as we age, we become fond of reflection. You know, self-reflection is part of our journey, isn't it? You know, you get to a point where you think about what you've learned, you think about how your life compares to, you know, when you meet someone younger and what their current experience is, and like, oh, that doesn't match up with my perspective because I'm at a different point in my life. I think the older we get, the more nostalgia means something to us because we have had the time to accrue those memories, to layer them upon each other. And I think the things that stick out to us, they're the most powerful memories. They're the ones worth holding on to. So, you know, the biscuits that your yaya would have served you with tea when you were growing up, like the smell of the orange rind, the texture of that dry biscuit, the way it would transform as you dip it into the cup of tea, all of those sensory things come back to you. And again, they're the simplest memories, but they are the most powerful. They're the ones that we're going to remember, you know, in our last days, you know, on this earth in these bodies. And yeah, I think for me, nostalgia is such a powerful tool in cooking. It's what the best chefs in the world of every level and caliber are able to wield in their kit of skills is how do you knit nostalgia into food? Like, you go to a three hat fine dining, you know, three Michelin star place, and things, sometimes food doesn't really look like food.
Yeah.
But if somehow you're able to infuse a scent, a texture, a flavor a shape into the food. Suddenly it goes from being that's a very overworked, fancy plate of food to I can taste my grandmother's brodo in this. And that's what gets people. That's what gets me as a writer and a person who works in food that does communicate those feelings is that. It's the magic. Nostalgia is one of the most powerful ingredients you can cook with.
So is that where alchemy comes in then, if I could go back to that? So it's about weaving nostalgia into the thing you present.
I think so.
And that's the alchemy.
Mm.
Like how would I get a carrot that, you know, this an orange thing that's, you know, the shape of a carrot and it's like just come out of the ground, whatever it is. It's sort of sitting there. I bought it at the market for a buck. And then how do I – it's funny, I had a conversation with Colin Fasnich one time about this exact point. He was telling me about – he was showing me how to cut up a carrot and he's saying, do you know that most people waste most of the carrot?
Mm.
And I couldn't believe the amount of detail that he knew about carrots and how to get the most out of it.
Yeah.
You know, like and don't waste anything, because one of the things I love about chefs, a good chef, is that they don't waste shit.
No.
Everything gets used. And it makes sense to me now. I never used to think about it, but it's, don't be wasteful when it comes to food or ingredients.
Not when you can sell it, not when you can value add. You look at the margins on restaurants, they're so fine. Why would you throw out something that can add an extra dimension of flavor to something? You know, peels and tops of carrots, for example, can be so many things, but the simplest thing you could do is collect them and turn them into a stock.
Yeah,
you know, it's a very, very easy thing. The you know, if you're going to throw them away, compost them for God's sake, because those nutrients can at least go back into some soil in your backyard, whatever it happens to be. But the alchemy thing, I think, is twofold. Yes, it's nostalgia. That's a, you know, a more lofty way of thinking about one of the many skills that chefs can have at their disposal. But also, it's the transformation of ingredients, so raw ingredients into amazing textures, amazing cohesion on the plate, all of the contrasting elements that bring together something that is deep and complex and bright and makes you feel something, is making you feel something as the nostalgia ingredient that is, you know, is blended in there. But you also need to have all of these other skills in transforming, you know, a root vegetable into maybe something that's invisible on the plate but gives great depth of flavour or sweetness or whatever it happens to be.
You now sort of made me think about the MasterChef series, which you've you've only announced you're not going to do any
nice
more MasterChef.
Segue.
Yes, very segue. But when you're on that show is, well, you tell me, is that show about what you just said?
Mm-hmm.
That is about no waste, alchemy, weaving nostalgia. Or is it, which sort of makes me think more about fundamental food, like basic food,
mm-hmm.
or is it more about theatre and presentation and emotions?
I think it's a mixed bag of all of those things. I think for me, the realisation that I have come to have reflecting on my time at MasterChef has been stories. We communicate our stories through food. If you are a cook, if cooking is part of the way you communicate to people, then you convey stories through that. So this is my grandmother's recipe. This is a recipe that is highly prized and deeply rooted in the culture that I'm from. This is what my mother would cook for me when, you know, in her last days. And this is something I wanted to share with you. So I think there are so many nuanced layers to what MasterChef is, but the one that I love is storytelling, and it's being part of the structure that allows people to feel comfortable enough to go there, to be vulnerable and to show who
they are.
The contestants, yep. To show who they are through what they cook. And yes, the mechanism of a giant clock and, you know, and fireballs in the ad break and all of those things, it's fun. It's a format that is easily digestible. It's easy to understand and it's light, and we need lightness in life. There are so many heavy, horrific things going on in the world, but we mustn't discount entertainment. it's the thing that gives us respite. It's the thing that allows us to pause and take a breath and just not think about things too much sometimes. And so I love the show because, yes, it has that lightness, but it still has depth to it. It still has a sense of purpose to it. And when you speak to contestants that have gone through the show, you know, a number of which I still keep in contact with, the party line about this show potentially transforming your life and allowing you passage into an industry that you've only dreamt of, that much is true. There is a tangible part of that. It can happen. It's not guaranteed, but it can happen. So there is that shining light at the end of the tunnel that is a potential outcome for a contestant that applies to go on the show as well.
So what's the role? What do you see as your role as a judge?
My role as a judge is a little bit of a few things. One of them is as a mentor. I think you
need... So guidance.
To guide, you know, there are fundamental parts of cooking that you need to guide people through, like... It's taken years, but I can smell within a degree if something's about to burn, and I know it. We all, like, if you're trained to smell it, you can't unsmell it, and you will go over to someone and say, that is seconds away from burning. I'd keep an eye on that because we are asking them to focus on all the other spinning plates that they have going on as well. And so it's about sort of giving them that technical advice. It's also, for me, I don't know that I walked into the role expecting it, but to be of an emotional support to people and to encourage them to feel like it was a safe space to be who they are in their shining moments, but also in their vulnerability and their failures, because as we all know, and the older that we get, the failure is so important. If you don't fail, if you don't embrace failure and the lessons and the gifts that it gives you, you are ignoring the most powerful things that life can teach you. So, you know, there's that part of it. So to create an environment in which people feel safe to fail is a privilege. And I get to do that on Dessert Masters still, even though it's a professional context. So the contestants are professional pastry chefs. We're still human though. So to continue to be associated with offering safe harbour is a privilege of who I have become in that space.
And was that in any stage confronting to you?
Totally.
Yeah, in the beginning.
Totally.
Because you probably didn't know what your real deal was when you rock up. Yeah, I'm going to be a judge. I can judge the food.
I turned up thinking, look, I know food. I can stand there in a pretty dress. I can deliver lines. I can tell you what I think about your food. I can do all the technical parts of the job for sure. It's fine. I can smile sometimes. But I think in the doing, I was humbled because the most powerful parts of what have resonated with people is in finding the power in human connection. Even when you're judging someone, you're still connecting with someone. You still need to know something of them in order to understand what they've produced and how they've produced it. So
you give them, basically you're giving them a place to reach out to you. So, you know, because you've got to get to know the people. I mean, and they're putting themselves on show.
They sign up for it, absolutely. And yes, connection is the goal. It's also impossible to connect on an extremely deep level with every single contestant, yeah, totally. Because you have up to 24 every single year coming through, and I can only imagine what it must be like for the former judges to have gone through 11 years of that. That's so many people. And of course you're not going to have that moment with everybody as much as you might want to. Statistically, it's just not possible. But when you do have that moment, that's really special, and that's what makes the job worth doing.
Can I sort of throw something out that's completely different to all that now? I mean, I want to talk about your writing after this, but today there's a lot of discussion about health span, lifespan, eating healthily.
Yeah.
And you know, they talk a lot about, for example, less meat, more or less protein
more
from
veg,
meat.
Less meat.
Yeah,
protein.
We lost more fiber, you know, gut biome, feed your gut biome and all that sort of stuff, you know, and have, you know, a soluble fiber as opposed to insoluble fiber. There's a lot of technical scientific stuff and there's a big movement around this stuff today.
Yeah.
Do we need to reconcile that with what you ordinarily would get presented with in terms of, let's call it tasty food or presentable food or theatrical food? Is it, how do we reconcile those two things?
I think we need both. You know, it's like art and science.
Yeah.
It's
one is art action, one is science. You're right.
Correct. But we need both to be human. You know, you can't take the art out of the world, otherwise what would be the point of living? But you can't live if you're not nourishing yourself.
So you've got to inject the science into the – are you talking about blending them?
So I think that both are important. You know, I celebrate indulgent, rich, beautiful things on television, and that's, you know, that's to be commended. You know, it's very difficult to create food like that, to generate bags of flavour, as Andy Allen would say, is hard, and you should acknowledge that someone is capable of doing that. But I don't go home and eat that way all of the time.
Right.
And I think that, you know, people, you know, see what people, you know, look up about me occasionally. And to think that I also eat like that at home, or that I go out to eat every single night of the week at, you know, fancy restaurants and things like that. Yes, there are times of my job where that is required, but you need to nourish yourself properly. You know, the fundamentals of being human is to keep the body alive, and to keep the body alive for a long time, hopefully, there are certain things you need to do. And that is, as you mentioned, all of the things. Pay attention to your gut microbiome, your fiber intake, you know, how you consume protein, what forms of protein you consume, macros, all of that. They're really important. So,
but we're also moving down the track now. You know, red meat's no good. Environmentally, you know, we've got those movements. So it seems to me that the food industry, or the restaurant industry, or let's call it the food preparation industry, has a few headwinds potentially up against it. And I don't say it's a bad thing or a good thing. It's just an observation of mine.
It's a complex web, because you need to think about this from the soil up.
Yeah.
And any farmer's going to tell you that. You don't have food if you don't have farmers. You don't have farms and food if you don't have healthy soil. This goes all the way down to the earth. And it's good to – yes, of course, we know that, say, excessive red meat consumption is not brilliant for our bodies. It's also not super sustainable. But if you take away beef farming, or you cut, you know, cattle farming in half, let's look at the human ramifications of that multi-generational family. They've been cattle farming for 8 generations on this land. Were you just telling them to cut their business in half? Where's the sustainability in that? Where's the human consideration for who they are and what they do next? What happens to the economy? You can't make, as you know better than I do, knee-jerk reactions economically and expect there to not be far-reaching ramifications of that. So we know that there are changes that need to be made for our diets, for the environment, the sustainability of our world. But it's a complex, moving, living thing, you know.
It's very dynamic.
It's an incremental move towards something better rather than a knee-jerk reaction where we just cut and run.
So does Mel Yong, in her writings, does in your comms work, you know, as a writer, do you feel in any way an obligation to build that reconciliation? And reconciliation is a word we use in lots of contexts in Australia. But do you and around the world,
complex word, isn't it?
Yeah, but these things will need to be reconciled. Because I tell you why, I listen to a lot of stuff about living longer and all that sort of stuff for the obvious reason, because I'm getting fucking old, you know. But
same,
mate. But like, and then I go out and I want to take my dad out for his 89th birthday, so I take him to somewhere he would not ordinarily go.
Mm.
And then, of course, all my sons want to come along, and you know, and then that's a 6-person event. And so I take him somewhere fancy, and I might go to, you know, dad likes Rockpool. the only time he ever goes Rockpool if I take him, but he likes Rockpool.
Someone else is picking up the correct. Check.
And it's not cheap, but and fortunately none of us drink. But so like we eat and we enjoy the meal and but you know what happens to me? I walk out and I think, fuck, I didn't have any vegetables. And I actually get a guilt trip from the other shit that I'm watching or reading about lifespan, health span. So no, but it's not not to you, but not a guilt trip, but I go, oh shit, like I've sort of interrupted my really good program. And I just think that I'd like to bring the two worlds together. And I wonder whether people like you could start these things, like reconciliation. And how do you live your life?
But this is the thing, it's not about eating perfect meals. Like as anyone in, you know, nutrition or, you know, the fitness space will tell you that one guilt meal, one cheat meal is not going to ruin your diet. It's about the cumulative total of what you do in a week, a month, a year. And as long as you're trending towards eating more of the things you know you should eat and, you know, scratching that itch. Because if I'm the kind of person, if I cannot get the thought of a slice of pizza out of my head, nothing I cook or eat that's not a pizza is going to be good enough.
So if you can't get it out of your head, stick it in your mouth.
So, well, pretty much, you know, go and get that, go and get the best possible slice of pizza. Like, enjoy it. Sit down. Don't be on your phone. Go and eat with someone that you love spending time with. Enjoy that moment. Savor it for what it is. You don't need to eat the whole pizza.
I would.
Whatever. Well, I mean, if it's really good, then you should. Because waste is also bad. But enjoy the moment, and then go back to making sure that you eat your vegetables and all of the rest of it. I think eating a really beautiful meal, like going to Rockpool with your family and not having enough vegetables or having the rich sauces or whatever it happens to be. I mean, God bless Beurre Blanc. I mean, come on. Rich, creamy sauces are...
Well, I love their chips.
Worth living. Chip, oh I mean... God.
And look. Their macaroni thing, whatever it was called. I mean,
hot oil and potatoes and salt. Never met one. Yeah, never met a combo I didn't
fat
like
and
that.
Salt and whatever it is. But do you think that, Mel, that at some point... Given these movements, that there will be restaurateurs who will exercise their alchemy and create these super healthy foods, but they're also fucking tasty.
There are chefs that specialise in that. That cook beautiful food that's really rich with nutrients, and that's all being considered. And those restaurants exist. They're not accessible for everybody, but they do exist. I think it's far more plausible and approachable for most people to, you know, you're wasting that expensive meal if you come away going, gosh,
I only thought about the next day. Vegetable. But I
enjoy the moment, I think, and then, you know, eat your chia pudding, whatever it is that you
I'm not that sort of fussy about it, but it's more a thought process, you know, because I'm thinking, and to some extent, I guess I'm getting a bit brainwashed because there is a movement and it's a bit like, as you said, older people tend to get nostalgic. Older people also tend to think about how the fuck do I'm going to live longer because, you know, the years are flashing by. And especially if you can afford it, which I'm in the fortunate position to be. So you tend to – but I sort of brainwash myself about this stuff and because I believe in it. I actually do believe in it. You know, because I believe you are what you eat, and the more healthy you are, the more healthy you will be. I think, and I often bemoan.
It's counterbalancing that with joy.
That's what I'm talking about. So, how do we bring the happiness and because we're going back to virtues.
Yeah.
You know, joy, gratitude, generosity. Are you saying then perhaps the people, like if I use me as one example, Mark, you need to learn or remember the importance of being generous to yourself, the importance of having gratitude for the opportunity to eat tasty food on this occasion, the importance of understanding how to enjoy yourself with everybody else who's around you as opposed to thinking about, is this really the right thing I should be eating? Are you saying that we are perhaps someone like me and maybe there's a new cohort of people starting to develop like this who are forgetting the reason why we eat together?
I think we can forget the reason why we eat together if we over-intellectualize food. If we only see food as fuel, you take the joy and the humanity out of what food can be. If you only eat for pleasure, then you take away the nourishment and, you know, the virtues that can be bestowed upon you in a health context from food. So I think that sometimes you can meet in the middle and you can have a healthy, delicious meal. But
it's hard to get if you go out.
Depends on where you go.
You know, I wouldn't know.
It depends on where you go. I mean, if you go to almost anywhere in the Byron Shire area.
Yeah, different. It's a long way to drive.
You can, that particular region does, it's a great, one of the great food bowls of Australia. So you get incredible produce that's grown locally. You have very talented chefs that are all attracted to living up there, producing incredible dishes with them, and you also have that lifestyle context, so they know their audience. Their audience.
What's your favorite restaurant?
There are so many. The Doma in Federal.
Yeah.
Love that.
Is that the Japanese place?
Yes. Yeah. It's like a Japanese. Yep. A Japanese.
The
cafe.
Hut is some other direction.
Yeah. Oh God, what did he call it? Matt Stone's now involved in it. I think they called it You Beauty or something like that. It's in Bangalore.
In Bangalore.
As well.
Yeah, I know.
The Eltham Hotel, guys running the Eltham. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great pub.
Tim Gogan, excellent chef. There are so many. At the Farm, obviously, it's a given.
But if you peel back to Sydney.
we're just down the road from Bondi, and that's, again, highly privileged areas are a magnet for what you're talking about, which is consolidating within one meal all the virtues and not sacrificing the joy and the flavour and the taste. And that's – so there's that. And for the lucky few, that is possible, that's accessible. But more and more when I speak to chefs, when I speak to people in food, if you – distill it down, there's no such thing as a superfood. There isn't. It's just foods have certain nutritional benefits. Some of them are synergistic when you consume them together, but the simplest food grown deep, like the best quality food that you can find, that you have access to, if you know how to cook, you can produce that for yourself. And I think that that's where we mustn't forget about the virtues of cooking. The skills of being able to nourish ourselves. If you know how to take a carrot, as you mentioned with our friend Fazzy, take a carrot and transform that into something that is delicious, and you can do that yourself. A carrot is not an expensive ingredient to purchase, so you empower yourself by knowing what to do with it.
He also told me don't go and buy it at the expensive food outlets, or the expensive grocers, because everything there is perfect. He said you can go and buy for
ugly veggies, 50%
of the – yeah, yes, he told me. He said you can, it's always much cheaper somewhere else. I want to move from there just to your new show on SBS. Can you just quickly tell me about what's going on there? Because it seems a bit offbeat for you.
Off-brand?
Yeah.
I'm all about – 2024 is the year of off-brand.
So what is it? What's the show called?
It's called The Hospital in the Deep End.
But so what is it about?
It's a three-part documentary series on SBS, and it's about a different look at the pressures on the public health system. So I was very fortunate to work with Samuel Johnson and Costa Georgiadis as well on this project. And we each have a different...
Costa Georgiadis as in the beard?
As in...
I saw him the other day at Bondi Junction. Yeah, he's cool.
He's a goddamn legend. He's sunshine in human.
And 100%. Like, I immediately felt warm towards him, like when I was talking. Like,
you just want to hug him.
He's so nice.
You just want to hug him. One of my favourite T-shirts that he has, that's the NWA Straight Out of Compton, it's Straight Out of Compost. It's just, there isn't.
So you guys are doing it together.
So we didn't spend a huge amount of time together because I guess we were tasked with going off to different parts of the hospital that related in some way to our life story. So, for Costa, it was vulnerable community outreach work. It was, he also attended a heart transplant because his father passed away from a heart attack in St. Vincent's Hospital, which was obviously a really challenging thing for him. For Sam, it was going into Panda, the drug dependency wards, talking about addiction, but also cancer research as well, which is a huge part of who he is and a tremendous contribution that he's given to Australians in terms of championing cancer research and raising money for it. He's excellent at that. For me, my mum being, she was a nurse unit manager in an emergency department, not at St. Vincent's, but a different hospital. And as we mentioned before, she pulled a lot of night shifts growing up. I didn't see my mum a lot. And so she was at this mystical place every single night. She would get in the car around sort of 9 p.m. I'd hear the door click and off she'd go. And she spent the whole night while I was asleep in this place contributing to saving lives. And I was given this unique opportunity to spend some time to get a glimpse into what that must have been like for her. And why would I say no to that opportunity? So I got to do that. I also got to spend some time in surgery. So I watched a breast reconstruction post-mastectomy. So the patient had decided 5 years on from having a single mastectomy that she wanted a reconstruction, and what they do is harvest tissue from the abdomen to reconstruct the breast. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to bear witness to this transformative operation for her, because this is going to give back some meaning to her life. You know, there was some part of her that she, you know, a tangible part of womanhood that she had lost in the cancer. And so to be there watching two plastic surgeons harvest tissue, reconnect blood vessels under microscopes over a 5-6 hour period, I mean, incredible. And that's a service that's offered in the public health system. And so to understand the care that doctors, nurses and admin staff in hospitals take for strangers on their worst days, and how much pressure is on the system to deliver these services and deliver them happily when there's so much pressure. In a post-COVID world, public hospitals, you know, everyone's gun-shy. Everyone's afraid that someone's going to lose it at them, because that's what has happened over the last couple of years. So to be able to meet these people in their environment, to understand why they do what they do, why they continue to do what they
do. So you're turning the spotlight on them and bringing it to life.
They're the real heroes.
That's
so
cool.
To bring voice to that was amazing. And it's not dissimilar to what I do on MasterChef, or what I've done on MasterChef, which is to be there to create a structure for other people's stories and to celebrate the stories of others. That's a great privilege. It's, for me, what I'm realizing as I get older and the longer I do this job, is it's about the fascination with human stories. That's really what lights my brain up.
Well, I've got one more thing before we close off.
I know where you're going.
So, I mean, how the hell does a petite, you're a petite young woman to me anyway, a petite young woman, and I was looking at your knuckles and I was looking at your hands and your ears. I can't see your ears, but your ears don't look too erect yet. But what's the MMA deal? Jiu-jitsu or what? What is it
like,
about?
Like I said, it's 2024, the year of doing off-brand things. And I joke about that, but I get a little bit of a giggle out of people being surprised by the other things that I'm interested in that don't seemingly connect. And MMA happens to be one of them. I think they all connect. It's all about human stories. I want to know what it takes for someone to sacrifice time with family, you know, go into fight camp for 3 months, and then ultimately walk into an octagon, have the cage door shut, and it's you and one other person stripped bare.
Well, you've got something
just
on.
Well, you've got something on. Not literally stripped bare. Yeah. It's just you.
So who are you doing it with? Where are you doing this?
I don't do MMA.
No, but are you going to comment on it, or were you writing about it? What's your role in it, or is it something?
I started off as just being an epic fan. I've done kickboxing and grew up with a family who was heavily into martial arts, but that's not what's informed this interest. For me, I think it started in the pandemic and I started watching UFC, and it's a fascinating sport. It's, from a business perspective, it's the, you know, fastest growing sport in the world. It's only young. It's only 30 years. 30 years, multi-billion dollar industry, flawless production. Everything about it is slick. It's amazing. It's well thought out and it's dynamic. And I love that part of it. So I recently hosted UFC 297 fight week for Fox Sports and my very first sports broadcasting gig.
Who were you on with? Who was on your panel?
I was on with Dan the Hangman Hooker and Tyson Pedro.
Okay, Tyson, yeah.
And my very first two interviews were with Dricus du Plessis and also
Sean Strickland. You got himself in a bit of trouble the other day.
Well, they have both gotten themselves into a lot of trouble.
But he looked like he was on the receiving end of me, like from what I saw. But
are you talking about the crowd fight?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that was.
But I thought he conducted himself quite well in the interview after. He was sort of quite composed.
Have you not seen the most recent footage? They're mates. They've been hugging it out in Toronto. So, you know, they've moved past the theatre and the drama of it all, and they just want to fight each other.
But are you going to go and do it?
Am I going to?
Are you going to go and learn jiu-jitsu or do something?
I feel like.
Do you feel compelled?
The network might not allow me to get punched in the face.
But I don't know. I mean, that you heal pretty quickly, especially if you eat the right food.
Was it bones heal, chicks dig scars? Is that that's the
But you do heal quickly. I can, because I did it this morning before I came here. I do
other things. Like I do interval training. I do Pilates. I need to keep fit in this job.
Do you ever feel compelled though to sort of start rolling around the joint and you know?
Jiu-jitsu is fascinating. Yeah. I think that jiu-jitsu, there's tremendous economy of strength, and people of small stature like myself can still find effective ways of subduing someone in that capacity. I think that jiu-jitsu is an amazing sport, but you know, MMA can be so many different different disciplines, which is brilliant, everything from boxing to Muay Thai and all the rest of it. And I think that's what I love about it, is it's like chess with dire consequences.
Yeah, a lot of strategy.
That's the way that I read it, is you have a kit bag of different disciplines, your opponent has a kit bag of different disciplines, and what's the strategy going into that? Like, how do you win that? And I think the unpredictability of the outcome is what makes UFC such an exciting sport. And I'm a huge fan. Like I said, I'm not a fighter myself, and I am still learning the technical elements of what it is, but what I feel like I can speak on and what I feel like I can contribute to is teasing out those stories of, I mean, you've got to have a chip on your shoulder, right?
To be a fighter.
Why do you fight? It's not just money.
You're trying to prove something.
I interviewed Sean Strickland, and he'd gotten to the point where he did not want to talk about his childhood trauma anymore. He did not want to talk about beef between him and du Plessis, but he just sort of said, oh, you know, like they just hand you stacks of cash and that's, you know, that's why I'm doing this fight. And that's utter bullshit.
Mm.
Money is not the ultimate motivator. If you're only motivated by money, you are going to be very disappointed in life, because it's hollow and it's fleeting. And if you don't have more to fight for than that, then life is not worth living. So I want to know what it is, like what it is about that person.
You want to bring this story out.
Yeah.
Again, it's like you do a MasterChef. It's funny, Bam Bam, the Thai two of us are sat right there. And he just said to me, like, if I hadn't have done UFC, I would never have had the opportunity to build a brand, which is all about a brand. The whole Shuey thing is a brand.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be able to get my own beer brand and all the other stuff that he's doing out there at Penrith. And get my family to have a better life. It's just opportunity, which you would never have otherwise had.
That's exactly it. And for some people, it's they're working out their demons. And had they not had the safe environment like UFC to work out their demons,
it might be done somewhere else.
They would be living a very, very different life. And in many ways, UFC might have saved them. So there are so many different reasons and purposes for why people do what they do. And the more I go down this road of meeting people of all different sorts of backgrounds, I want to know what their reasons for living are. It's like much like what you do with this podcast. It's why are you here?
That's something I'm trying to find out from you
today.
Why
are you here?
And I think I found out a lot of really cool stuff. And I mean, you're a little bit random. In that you sort of
I'm putting that on my CV.
But you are a little bit random in terms of the things you do, but yeah. But equally, there's a common denominator.
Yeah.
And the common denominator on all of these is what's someone's story? How can you bring that to life?
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. And that's actually a real privilege.
It is. It really, really is. having someone trust you enough to share is incredible. And that's what I get out of it, is the honor that I feel that someone would feel like I'm safe enough to bear what they have to say, to hold who they are. That's really cool. I mean, it's all about human connection. You know, there's lots of different complexities that have I've experienced in life that have led me to feel the lowest lows and the highest highs. And if that's me in my very random life, I mean, my career has been incredibly piecemeal. There's no strategy to it other than to feel my way through it and feel what is true to me and hold on to that and chase it. If I can feel that, then I want to meet people that are open enough to want to share in return why they are the way that they are.
It's interesting that you get a great deal of satisfaction and joy out of someone trusting you enough to feel like they're in a safe, they are safe enough to tell you the story, because that becomes an affirmation of your own morality. For me, because I do it, that's what I do every day. But it just means that Mark, you act properly. No one feels like you know you're going to pull their shorts down in public. You know, like they are happy enough to tell you what drives them, what they feel good about. And in a selfish way, it's important to me because it sort of confirms some of my ethics about myself.
Yeah.
And I go back to that, you know, point I made very early in the discussion today. Sometimes we do these things for selfish reasons, which aren't bad selfish reasons. They're good selfish reasons, because everybody gets something out of it. And it always comes back to our ethics, what we value in life.
Yeah. You know? Ego is really important. I think that ego can run rampant, and, you know, when it's disproportionate to what else you fit into your life, that's where danger can happen. But the ego is still our guiding principle. It's what protects us. It's what keeps us safe and gives us a sense of individuality. But it's all part of it. And to the selfish part of it is the inevitable comparison of questioning and comparing your morality and your code of ethics against other people. And I think the more self-aware you become, the more you're able to kind of do that in a healthy context. And the hope is always that you can learn something that will take you to the next level of, I don't know, understanding, appreciation of life, whatever it happens to be, just contentment, peace.
And awareness.
Awareness. I mean, it's a two-edged, you know.
It can be scary.
It can be really scary. It can be dark. And it can make you feel lonely depending on what room you're sitting in. Mm. I've learned that the hard way. You cannot expect people to meet you where you are, and you can't resent them for not being where you are. You have to just accept people for who they are and make peace with that sometimes.
Well, Mel Leong, that is a pretty good way to end this off. Thanks very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you so
it.
Much.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.